Welcome to Eastern Standard, produced for WEKU by Dynamics Productions. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for joining us. And we're going to begin the hour with Tom Eblin's latest in his series of conversations with Kentucky authors. The subject, criminal justice and human rights. His guest, Stephen Bright.
Stephen Bright grew up in Danville and was student government president at the University of Kentucky in 1970 during the major protests against the Vietnam War. Bright went on to become a renowned human rights lawyer and opponent of the death penalty. He was the longtime director of the Southern Center for Human Rights in Atlanta, as well as a law professor at Yale and Georgetown Universities. Bright's work in trying to overturn unjust death sentences has made him the subject of two books and a movie. Bright is now retired and living in Lexington. With help from former student James Quack, he has just published an important new book, The Fear of Too Much Justice: Race, Poverty, and the Persistence of Inequality in the Criminal Courts. The book explores the deep flaws in America's criminal justice system, flaws that Bright spent his career fighting. He offers many sensible but politically difficult solutions for making the criminal justice system more just for those without power, status, and money. Steve Bright is here with us to talk about The Fear of Too Much Justice. Steve, welcome to Eastern Standard.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, tell us a little about the book and what led you to write it.
Well, the book is based really on something that happened at the Supreme Court in 1987, when the court had before it a case involving the racial disparities in the infliction of the death penalty in Georgia. And Justice Powell wrote the opinion for the majority. It was a 5-4, very close decision. He said, if we deal with race disparities with regard to the death penalty, we'd have to deal with race disparities with regard to other kinds of sentencing, when robberies and other cases in the criminal courts. And Justice Brennan said he thought that was the fear of too much justice. And I think it explains not only that case and the court's unwillingness to deal with race and the death penalty, but a whole lot of different issues, poverty, mental illness, jury selection, all sorts of things where we really know what we ought to be doing. We really ought to be wrestling with these issues. Some places have, but most have not. And that just echoes to me in what I've seen the last 40, 45 years. Is that there really is a fear of too much justice.
Well, you mentioned that some states have better systems than others. A lot of your book deals with Georgia, where you worked, and Texas, which has had a lot of issues. How does Kentucky compare?
Well, I think in Kentucky, you've got good and bad points. I mean, one of the points that we talk about a lot is the importance that a poor person accused of a crime is adequately represented. The Supreme Court once said there can be no equal justice when the kind of justice a person gets depends upon the amount of money they have. Unfortunately, it does very much depend upon that. Kentucky has a statewide public defender system, something to be proud of. A lot of very dedicated people have made that a great organization, but it's woefully underfunded, and that's what we see all across the country, is there's just a feeling that if we give people zealous representation, which is what they're entitled to, that would be too much justice, that maybe some guilty people would be acquitted. We wouldn't get as many convictions. And so we sort of go along with this almost mediocrity in terms of representation that's provided, not because the people aren't conscientious, just because the workloads are too great. You just can't do that much, you know, with that kind of workload.
One thing you mentioned is the power that prosecutors have in our system, and it's in some ways even more powerful than what the judges have. Tell us a little about that.
Oh, absolutely. One example we give is a prosecutor in Georgia who offered two different women the opportunity to get a life sentence if they would just agree and plead guilty. But when they didn't, he said, well, I'm seeking the death penalty. And they still went to trial, and both of them ended up getting the death penalty. One of the closing arguments, he said, you know, this is a crime that the only appropriate punishment for this crime is the death penalty. Well, he knew good and well that wasn't true, because he had offered the person life imprisonment if they would plead guilty. So they got the death penalty because they didn't take the plea offer. And no judge has any control over that. The prosecutor decides whether to seek the death penalty, whether or not to, whether to offer a plea bargain, whether or not to. Another thing that we talk an awful lot is cutting deals with people. In both of those cases, the prosecutor cut deals with the man involved in those two cases, and he testified against them and avoided the death penalty, while the two women involved, who were not as culpable, they ended up getting sentenced to death.
What's another major issue that that you see in the system, and how would you fix it if you could?
Well, one of the most troubling things, I think, is the number of people with serious mental disorders who come into the criminal courts because there's no other place for them to go. They're just dumped into the courts, and the jails and the prisons that house so many mentally ill people are not the places that they should be. But again, there's just not the willingness. When we had the deinstitutionalization of those people back in the 50s and 60s, the promise was that there were going to be community mental health programs for them. But that's never really been realized. But the one example we point to is in Miami, where a very visionary judge down there had all the police departments, whether it's the Miami Police Department, Dade County, whether it's the school police department, everybody trained in how to deal with people that had mental illness, and then had this mental health center that provides all sort of housing, everything, from dental care, medical care, mental health care, and it's a whole different way of treating people with mental illness who come into the courts.
Well, there have been a lot of studies about how many more people in America are incarcerated than other countries and how much more we spend on it, yet we still don't do a lot about that. We don't look for other solutions. Why do you think that is?
Well, I think part of it is just culturally that's what we've been doing for so long. I think one of the reasons that we're different from other countries is because of all the guns. We're a highly armed society, and small arguments often end up being, you know, homicides because somebody picks up a gun and shoots somebody else, or even somebody is wounded. We have a lot of suicides, of course, because of that too. But that means that, you know, a lot of harm is visited upon people when a gun is used in a robbery or in an argument or whatever it may be. And then often the punishment is very severe. Of course, the other thing is that we don't treat addiction as a health problem. We treat it in the criminal courts. So instead of trying to deal with addiction to drugs and alcohol and gambling, sex and all those things, we criminalize those. And so we have an awful lot of people that are addicted who are in the jails and prisons in this country. And that's unfortunate.
Your book has got a lot of examples of how the death penalty was used unfairly and unjustly, innocent people who ended up getting the death penalty. It has such a checkered history in America, but yet it seems to still have a lot of popular support, or at least support among politicians and a certain segment of the population that elects them. Why do you think that is?
Well, it's very problematic, isn't it? I mean, you know, if you took Germany, for example, if it had the death penalty today and most of the people getting the death penalty were Jewish, I think most of the world would recoil in horror about that. But here in the United States, we have the death penalty, and it's visited upon people who were historically enslaved and then subject to segregation and all sort of brutal discrimination. But we know that the death penalty costs a lot of money. It's very arbitrarily. It's only imposed in a few counties in the entire country. But in those counties, it's inflicted quite a bit. And very often, the people that get the death penalty are distinguished more than anything else by their poverty, the poor quality of lawyers they had represent them. Very often, their mental disorders. Some people that could have taken a plea offer and avoided the death penalty end up going to trial and getting it because they're profoundly mentally ill. But we're seeing a huge decline in the death penalty. In the 1980s and 90s, when I first started doing this work, we were sentencing somewhere around 300 people to death every year. The last 5 years, it's more like 30 or 40. So we've just seen a huge decline in the death penalty. The number of states used to be 38 had it. Now it's only 27. Two of those don't have a single person on death row, and many of those have not sentenced anybody to death in 10 years. So the death penalty is dying, a sort of long, drawn-out death. But we are getting closer to when we'll finally have it behind us here in the United States.
Well, you cite so many problems with the system. What can the average citizen do to try to affect change?
Well, I think what people have to realize is that some of these issues that, as we say, don't have a constituency. Robert F. Kennedy said when he was the attorney general, the poor person accused of a crime has no lobby. And the point he was making is that, you know, although the Supreme Court has said everybody's entitled to a lawyer, it didn't say anything about how to pay for those lawyers. And county commissioners and state legislators and other people don't want to spend money on the public defender system and making sure that people are adequately represented. But this court system can't possibly work without that. I mean, that's fundamental. And people have to realize that if we're going to have a system that, you know, the most fundamental thing the system does, separate the guilty from the innocent. For goodness sakes, we don't want innocent people going to prison. We don't want innocent people being sentenced to death. But that's happening. And part of the reason for that is because people are poorly represented, unfortunately.
Well, again, the book is The Fear of Too Much Justice, Race, Poverty, and the Persistence of Inequality in the Criminal Courts by Stephen Bright and James Quack. Steve, thanks for being with us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
For Eastern Standard, this is Tom Evelyn with the Carnegie Center for Literacy and Learning.
Concerns about gun violence had the attention of Divine Karama, director of the city's One Lexington program, and Gerald Smith's guest for his series on racial justice and equality.
We want to begin by introducing, you know, some of our listeners to One Lexington. So what is One Lexington? Why was it established? You know, when was it established? And give the listeners a sense of, you know, your job description.
Sure. So One Lexington was created under Jim Gray's administration, I believe back in 2017, in response to the shooting and killing of Olympic track star Tyson Gay's daughter, who was from Lexington, Kentucky. And we were getting a lot of national news as gun violence was starting to spike around that time. And so he created this organization. But there never really was any resources put into it, in my opinion. And then the pandemic hit in 2020, and that really kind of impacted the effectiveness of One Lexington. The prior director to me was Laura Hatfield, a friend of mine, and she really did some great preventative work in the Wimburn neighborhood in her stint as director. And so coming out of the pandemic, Laura took another job with the city. Like nationally, Lexington was seeing another huge spike in gun violence. And so our new mayor, Linda Gordon, was really wanting to take One Lexington to the next level, put some investment into it. And so in the summer of 2021, she hired me as the director. And so I'm coming on my 2-year anniversary. And the mission for One Lexington is to leverage government resources and community partnerships to reduce gun violence for youth and young adults ages 13 to 29. 70% of the gun violence has been driven or has impacted that specific age purview in the last 5 to 6 years, which is why we intentionally focus on that age group. And I feel like after a couple of rocky years, we're starting to make an impact.
Mm-hmm. So you say a couple of rocky years. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, definitely. So we were in crisis the summer that I took over. I believe the week that I started, I want to say it was June 7th, we had 3 or 4 juveniles that were shot that week. And I believe we had 2 or 3 homicides that month. We had hit a record number of homicides the year prior, and we were on pace in summer of 2021 to eclipsing that record, which we eventually did. Going into 2022, we were still seeing some of the same issues that we were seeing in 2021, except for there were some new challenges that were introduced in the fight to reduce gun violence. We saw a historic spike in domestic violence. I believe 40% of our gun-related homicides in 2022 were domestic violence-related, where prior the focus had been on gangs, it had been on young people, and now we were seeing this explosion of domestic violence and even mental health-related homicides You may remember the mother who stabbed her two children. There was a man who committed a murder-suicide. He killed his whole family. And so these were things that we typically didn't see here. And so 2022 saw us once again eclipse our record number of homicides. And so it was definitely a rocky first couple of years.
So what is your response to those individuals who believe that gun violence in the community stems from either a lack of parental control, issues with mental illness, or even a lack of role models in the community? What is your response to those individuals who believe those are the reasons for gun violence?
I definitely think those are some of the reasons. I think a lot of what we fought for, a lot of what dominated the headlines in 2020 in regards to the social unrest, and the inequities that still exist in communities of color, those same issues are prevalent in this fight. Those are some of the root causes that lead to the gun violence that we've seen. So definitely those things play a part. As you encounter more violence within the community, trauma starts to impact a lot of these young people. And so I think you got this trauma and mental health, as you mentioned, that goes untreated, that plays a part. But I also think we're seeing a culture shift, and it's something that we have to talk about. When we talk about the music, when we talk about social media, when we talk about the easy access to firearms, and then the cultural glorification of gun violence and firearms that we are seeing, I think that that also plays a part. And I think our approach to One Lexington has been to focus on both, which is why we've seen, we're starting to get some national attention, but why we've seen so much progress here in Lexington, and why we've seen such a decrease. And even last year, when we saw an overall spike in homicides, we actually saw a 70% reduction in youth and young adult gun-related homicides. And I think it is because we're focusing on the short-term stuff, but we also got to focus on the long-term, or in another 10 years or so, we'll be right back where we are now.
Mm-hmm. So your work definitely involves creating and promoting community partnerships. What are some of the programs, strategies that you are employing this summer of 2023 to encourage community uplift and progress and continuing the decline in gun violence?
We operate through CVI, which is not to be confused with GVI, but it's kind of community violence intervention, which focuses on those partnerships that you mentioned. And so we operate through the PEER model. And that PEER is an acronym for prevention, intervention, enforcement, and reentry work. Our intervention is how we impact in families that are already impacted by gun violence, so that we don't see that retaliatory gun violence that often follows, or that trauma that you mentioned in mental health. Our prevention is how are we getting to these young people before they get in the cycle of violence. Our reentry work is how are we working and providing alternative pathways for those youth and young adults who are currently incarcerated or about to come home or recently coming home. How are we supporting them so that they don't go back into that cycle of violence? And then obviously we don't have any enforcement capabilities, but for the enforcement part of PEER, how are we bridging the gap with law enforcement and communities of color where there's that generational distrust? And so this summer, we're taking the strategy that we use all year long, except for we're operating in something called All Hearts on Deck, where we are trying to get people outside. We are trying to get people more engaged. We are trying to amplify youth programming and not being afraid of the violence, but trying to get people to reclaim their neighborhood and stand up against it. Because the data shows us that when we retreat, and we go in, that leaves idle spaces for violence to occur. And it's a kind of an emboldened feeling of being unchecked. And so we can't do that any longer as a community. And so how do we amplify the community? How do we encourage them to come out and be a part of the fight? That's what we're focused on this summer.
Mm-hmm. Have you been successful in building bridges with all parts of Lexington?
I think so. I think post-election, it's been a lot easier. Mm-hmm. This is my first government job, and so I think I underestimated the impact of working in an administration, whereas I come from a grassroots background. So for me, it's just all about the work. It's all about the people. But when you throw politics in there and you work for an administration, I really started to see how that dynamic played out. And so there was a lot of divisiveness early in my tenure because we were in an election year last year. And so quite a few people that normally would be at the table with us were kind of holding their breath and waiting to see the outcome of the election. And just seeing how that played a role was new for me. Mm-hmm. But I can honestly say post-election, we've really been able to come together. And I think we were really in a space where a lot of us are all finally leaving our silos and really coming together and just focusing on the people.
Mm-hmm. So what other resources do you need in order for One Lexington to continue to make a difference in the community? Are you getting the kind of support from a funding standpoint?
The funding isn't really an issue anymore. The first year, we only had about a $20,000 budget because I was hired after the budget had passed. So I just kind of got the scraps that were left over. But the previous council, the current council, the mayor has continued to elevate the level of funding each year when they've seen the impact that we've made. And so for me, it is more the community support, the community buy-in. That's more the resources that we need right now, whether it's the faith community, whether it's those individuals who are out on the block each and every day, partnerships within the school system, and just the community involvement. Gun violence reduction isn't something the government can do on its own and really shouldn't even be leading. The government should be removing barriers so that the community can lead. And so just continued community buy-in, I think, is the biggest thing that we need right now.
How would you describe race relations in Lexington now in 2023?
To be honest, I think we're about the same as we were in 2020. I think there are some moves being made from the top down that hopefully can kind of re-energize those conversations and the things that we started in 2020. Mm-hmm. I think Tiffany Brown, who's the implementation officer in the mayor's office, I think she's doing great work in regards to equity and diversity and really trying to make good on those promises that the mayor and the city made back in 2020. But I think we, you know, what we felt in 2020 wasn't just a thing of the moment, right? A lot of our people here in Lexington have been living these disparities and injustices for generations. And I think for a lot of people, it was just the talk of the moment. And I think once 2020 passed, some things went back to business as usual. And so I think we need to continue to apply pressure. And I think Tiffany is doing a great job. I think there's a permanent racial commission now through the mayor's office. And I think that that's great. But I think that we need to continue to apply the pressure. It can't go back to the status quo. It can't just be, we can't wait until the next police shooting happens or high profile event happens, because people are dealing with this reality every day. So I just think we need to continue to apply the pressure.
Well, thank you very much. That's One Lexington Director Divine Karama. I'm Gerald Smith for Eastern Standard.
Coming up after the break,
it has become virtually impossible to dissuade legislators from enacting laws that do great harm to the public's right to know.
Plus, a program that combines housing and recovery support with training for jobs in the horse industry, and a look at what surrounds the Kentucky River top to bottom. I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
This is Sherry Lawson with coming events from Kentucky Humanities. On Monday, June 26th, the Carroll County Library in Carrollton will host Kentucky Reads, the Bookwoman's Daughter book discussion. The program will begin at 1 p.m. Also on Monday, June 26th, the Church of the Ascension in Mount Sterling will host Speakers Bureau 1812, Remember the Raisin, presented by Eddie Price. The program will begin at 7 p.m. and is sponsored by the Montgomery County Historical Society. On Tuesday, June 27th, the Meade County Public Library in Brandenburg will host Kentucky Chautauqua, Aunt Molly Jackson, Pistol Packin' Woman. The program will begin at 5 p.m. For more information on programs and coming events, visit kyhumanities.org. For Kentucky Humanities, I'm Sherry Lawson.
If it's done on government time, are its details readily available to you, the public? We're joined by Amy Bensonhaver, a retired assistant attorney general whose 25-year career in the Kentucky AG's office focused exclusively on the open records and meetings laws, and that focus has carried over into retirement. Amy now leads the Kentucky Open Records Coalition, advocating for Kentucky's Sunshine Laws, writing extensively on victories, defeats, and other developments in the laws. She has championed the laws in the courts, the legislature, and behind scenes. Welcome to Eastern Standard, Amy.
Thank you.
And if you would first just tell us about the mission of the coalition.
Well, in 2019, we witnessed a really unprecedented assault on Kentucky's open government laws, in particular, the open records law, prompting me and an individual who is a former editor of the Kentucky New Era, Jennifer Brown, to consider the value of a public voice for open government. Too often, the public's voice is obscured because very often media interests kind of supersede the public's voice. And to the extent that the laws extend open records and open meetings extend to both the media and the public, we wanted to be sure that the public's voice was heard. And so that was why we created the coalition in 2019. And even at that time, we had greater success in convincing legislators that some of the proposed changes to the law were adverse to the public's interest. In that short period of time that has elapsed since 2019, it has become virtually impossible to dissuade legislators from enacting laws that do great harm to the public's right to know.
Well, let's look at what's at stake here. What kinds of information held by government, local, state, should be accessible by the public?
Our law kind of foresaw the evolution of technology. So we're talking about everything. We're talking about documentation, regardless of physical form or characteristic, the law tells us, that is possessed, owned, used, retained, you know, by a public agency. So we're talking about virtually everything that relates to a public agency's business. Where the challenges have come into play is where powerful lawmakers want to evade accountability by excluding themselves from the open records law, and where technology appears to erect a barrier to access, but in reality, absolutely extends by the express terms of the statute. So what we're talking about, the kind of disputed issues now, those that are the hot button issues, are access to email, text, any kind of electronic communication on a public official's private device or account, that there's a strong resistance to access to those types of records. And of course, our legislature, which likes to preach to us what we should do, but not do it itself. This is the, I guess, second year that it has been exempt from the open records law. So, yeah, these are the kind of things right now that are very topical.
Well, somebody listening to us might say, well, why should a public official's private email or private phone be fair game?
I think the statute itself addresses that. No one has ever asserted a right to any kind of private communications relating to purely private matters. In 2018, when Damon Thayer proposed to redefine the term public record to exclude private communications, the settlement was reached where basically there would be a new exception to the open records law that says all purely private communication, a personal communication, is not subject. There's even a downside to that in candor because, you know, some public officials conduct public business on state time and some public officials engage in very inappropriate conduct when it comes to sexual harassment. during state hours. But the reality is that resolution takes care of, in general, the biggest issue, which is nobody really cares if someone needs to make a doctor's appointment or someone has an illness in their family or has a family obligation. That's not what we're talking about. What we're talking about is public officials who seek to evade public accountability by defaulting to the use of their private devices or their private accounts to avoid the application of the law. And that issue is currently in the Court of Appeals. The Kentucky Open Government Coalition is represented in that case by John Flyshaker, Michael Abadi, and Rick Adams of the Louisville law firm of Kaplan, Johnson, Abadi, and Byrd. So we have the best lawyers we could possibly have representing the public's right of access to those communications on those private devices or on those public accounts that relate to public business and that are conducted on those private accounts for the purpose of evading public accountability.
When you're accessing data or information from someone's private phone or private email, is it specific to the issue that you're concerned about? In other words, is the rest of it redacted or not?
Obviously, the law in 1991, when I first came to the Attorney General's office, didn't really encompass electronic communication. I vividly remember the first open records decisions involving electronic communications. It occurred in about 1995. So in general, we weren't looking at that in 1991. But as time has gone by, you know, there's a reality here that you can almost always analogize an electronic communication to a hard copy communication. And what that basically means is no more than I would be required as an individual who might have records responsive to an open records request, no more than I would be required to roll every file cabinet I have into the records custodian's office so that that records custodian could just randomly search through my hard copy files to find responsive records, then would I be responsible for handing my phone over to the records custodian? The approach that the law envisions is that an agency receives an open records request. The custodian of records sends out feelers to all agency employees, officials who might have responsive records. They are then responsible for reviewing their own files. And in this case, it would be their telephone records, their texts, their emails to see if they have any responsive or their computer records, I should say, as well, their email account records to say, see if they have any responsive records, managing and retaining them as public records, and then forwarding them to the custodian of records who would then review those records and determine which had to be disclosed because they were not exempt. And of course, the law has a presumption favoring disclosure. So the reality is we're no more asking for the surrender of a phone and someone randomly scrolling through all of the messages on an email account or a text account. What we are anticipating is that a public official or employee would conduct a search through their own records, just as they would if they had to go to their file cabinet and pull out responsive memoranda or whatever it might be, forward those to the records custodian, who, with the agency's counsel's assistance, would review those and determine what has to be disclosed. And again, it's never been an issue of surrender of a private cell phone or allowing someone to just do a phishing expedition through private communications.
Does the law state how much time that government agency has to provide the information?
The statute was amended in 2021 to extend the deadline, which we had a relatively short deadline of 3 business days. If you look nationally, it is one of the features of our law that is critical, is having a specific deadline for agency final response, and that it used to be 3 business days. In 2021, it was amended to 5 business days, so not a dramatic shift. One of the things the law does permit and that has become wildly abused is a provision that states that if a request is burdensome or if it is extensive, that the records are in active use and storage or otherwise unavailable, on that 5th business day, the agency can notify the requester, look, we've gotten your request. It encompasses hundreds of thousands of documents. let's just say. Obviously, they cannot produce those records if they contain any protected information within 5 business days. So the statute basically allows them to extend that 5 business day deadline. But the statute also goes on to say that that explanation has to be accompanied by a detailed explanation of the cause for delay. So it's not just because it's inconvenient at this time, but we've got a lot of other responsibilities on our plate right now. They can extend the deadline. They have to give a detailed explanation in writing, and they have to identify the earliest date on which those records will be available. And that is a commitment to release those records on that date certain. But unfortunately, that is often abused and exploited by public agencies that simply don't want to produce the records within the statutory timeframe.
Amy, this may seem to some like a very dry, dull issue involving files and documents and bureaucracy and such, but what are some real-life consequences of being denied access to these kinds of records?
I like to point to a case from the 2012, 2013, 14, 15, a case that was extensively litigated because the Cabinet for Health and Family Service resisted disclosure. That was the case involving child fatality and near fatality records. The children under the supervision and monitoring of the Cabinet for Health and Family Services subject to the open records law. And there is a requirement under law that they create reports of child fatalities and or near fatalities of these children. Debbie Yetter, Ryan Craig, Bill Estep, some really top-notch reporters, began to make inquiries about these child fatality and near fatality cases. And what was ultimately disclosed was that the cabinet was not disclosing any of these records. They had some latitude within their statute to withhold some of these records, but their policy was to disclose none of these records, because what these records exposed was the inability of the cabinet to discharge its duties, the fact that it had an inadequate workforce of social workers, that it simply was dropping the ball on its statutory duties, and the casualties in this case were helpless, you know, children who absolutely needed their protection. And so after, 5 years of litigation, 2 cases, the imposition of $756,000 in penalties and $400,000+ in attorney's fees, the cabinet ultimately disclosed those records. A Child Fatality and Review Commission was created to address the problems that existed within the cabinet that was preventing it from discharging these duties or obstructing its ability to discharge these duties. So ultimately, I like to say in many cases, the stakes are so high, it literally means life or death. But every request submitted by every open records requester, short of those, and there are very, very, very few of those whose intentions are purely for harassment purposes, and that's even addressed in the statute. So the reality is there are very few requests that are submitted for any reason other than in the eyes of that individual, a legitimate purpose and a much needed purpose.
All right. That's Amy Benson-Haver. She leads the Kentucky Open Records Coalition. Thank you so much, Amy.
Thank you.
Across Kentucky, the horse industry needs more workers. At the same time, people who are recovering from addiction or have recently been freed from prison need peer support and jobs. Separate drug recovery and prison-based vocational programs in Lexington have found similar solutions, providing both job training and a second chance. More about this from the Daily Yonder's Anya Slepian.
Tyler Harris has been to rehab 6 times in the last 10 years. At one point, he had nearly 5 years of sobriety, but he could never get it to stick.
My normal thing is I'll go to a 30-day treatment. I'll stay sober for 30, 60, 90 days after. But those are all on my own. I'm not, like, connected. I'm not surrounding myself with the right people. And I fall back into my old ways so quickly, it's not even funny.
This time, he's trying something new. Harris is one of 26 men currently participating in the Stable Recovery Program in Lexington, Kentucky. The program combines housing and recovery support with job training that prepares participants to work in the equine industry. Will Dorton helped start Stable Recovery. He says the program's built-in therapeutic community and emphasis on job training provide an alternative model of recovery.
You don't necessarily need to go to a $30,000 a year treatment facility. You don't necessarily need to go to prison. You don't necessarily need to go into a hospital. If you get a job that means something to you and you live in an environment that will support you, you'll be able to recover.
For their first 90 days at Stable Recovery, participants are enrolled in the School of Horsemanship at TaylorMade Farm, which trains people in recovery to work as grooms. Program founder Frank Taylor said he started the school to help solve what he sees as two interrelated crises: high rates of opioid and alcohol addiction, exacerbated by the COVID-19 pandemic, and a labor shortage in the equine industry. When Taylor first suggested starting the School of Horsemanship for people in recovery, his brothers, who are also his business partners, were not enthusiastic about the idea. But Taylor, who had seen a similar model work wonders at a local restaurant, was adamant that they give the program a try.
My response was, well, what if we save somebody's life? What if we reunite a family? What if we turn somebody that's a drain on society into somebody that contributes positively to society? So I just think the upside outweighs the downside.
And so far, it has. Around 70 students have graduated from the School of Horsemanship, several dozen of whom are now employed at TaylorMade Farm or elsewhere in the horse industry. TaylorMade Farm's staffing shortage has been addressed, and the demand for graduates of the program has spread to other farms. The addition of the Stable Recovery program has also created a unique opportunity for people in recovery. For one thing, the program has no set end date.
To have that is special. It's just because, you know, the years of doing what us guys have been doing, to think that you can just fix that all in 30 days is not realistic. And I've proven that to myself so many times.
After graduating from the School of Horsemanship, Harris chose to move permanently from Bowling Green to Lexington to continue the Stable Recovery program. He is now a barn foreman at TaylorMade. On the other side of town, the Blackburn Correctional Complex offers a horsemanship program for incarcerated men. The Second Chances Farm is funded by the Thoroughbred Retirement Foundation, a nonprofit organization dedicated to rescuing retired thoroughbreds that may face abuse or neglect after their racing career is over. The farm at Blackburn was started more than 20 years ago and is now one of 8 similar programs in prisons across several states. Rescue horses from the foundation are kept on the prison grounds and cared for by incarcerated people who learn the skills necessary to work on a horse farm. But historically, few graduates have been able to get jobs in the horse industry once they were released, despite the severe labor shortage many farms are facing. Kim Weir is the director of donor engagement at the Thoroughbred Retirement Foundation.
So we, for the longest time, really had what I call a two-legged stool. We had a really efficient solution where the horses were well taken care of and the prisons were happy with their guys and gals having good jobs to teach them great skills. So it was, those two things were great.
But Weir says an important piece of the puzzle was still missing. Neither the Thoroughbred Retirement Foundation nor the Kentucky Department of Corrections is well suited to help with job placements. That's where Lori Mays comes in. Mays is the project manager for the Agriculture and Equine Talent Pipeline at the Kentucky Chamber of Commerce.
When we started talking to Blackburn, there wasn't a great connection between the gentlemen who were being released and graduated from that program and the industry that desperately needed those people.
Since Mays first got involved in the Blackburn Farm in 2019, she has worked to connect employers with graduates of the horsemanship program. She has also created the Workforce Readiness and Reentry Program, which provides the incarcerated men with mock interviews, resume writing help, and information about navigating the horse industry.
There's so many qualified gentlemen that come out of there, but a lot of times their only exposure to the horses was in prison.
The Kentucky Chamber also provides wraparound services, which help with issues like transportation and housing to support employers and their new employees in the transition out of prison. For men like Chris Courtney, this support is critical. Courtney was released from Blackburn in 2015, but was unable to find steady work on a farm due to his felony record.
I struggled for a couple of years trying to get a job, and much less a horse farm job, because they have to trust you. I had gotten a couple of jobs, but by the end of the day, they would call me in the office and they'd say, well, we're going to have to let you go because of your record, your felony, or so be it, you know, and I'd be so disappointed. And I just want to cry, you know, and there's a couple of times I did. I just cried.
Eventually, Courtney got in touch with Mays, who connected him with Jeannie and Nick Larkin, the owners of Wainui Farm in Lexington.
It's like dominoes falling. I've been here like going on 2 years now. It's been a blessing for me.
According to Mays, nearly 70 graduates of the Blackburn program have been hired by the equine industry since 2019, and no participants have ended up back in prison since the talent pipeline was established. This is especially notable given that nearly 30% of people released from Kentucky prisons will return there within a few years.
There's a lot of hurdles that these guys have to overcome, and it's not always within their control. You know, there is a lot of statistics out there that if people aren't employed within the first 2 to 3 weeks after release from incarceration, the percentage of them that do recidivate is huge.
Courtney says that Mays and Larkin and the employment they provided are what has kept him out of prison.
I was in there for 10 years flat, okay? And I would see guys come in 2 or 3 times, come in, get out, come in, get out, come in, get out. And I'd be like, man, this is a revolving door. So I know I'd be one of those statistics.
The partnership between the Blackburn program and the Chamber of Commerce has helped break that pattern over the past few years, says Kim Weir from the Thoroughbred Retirement Foundation.
Every single guy that has wanted a job in horse world, they have walked out the door of Blackburn with a uniform and a job waiting for them.
This model is already being recreated at other prison farms in Maryland and Florida. While not directly connected, the programs at Blackburn, Stable Recovery, and TaylorMade Farms each demonstrate the effect that a jobs program can have on people's lives.
We're showing people what hope looks like. We're showing people what the power of a second chance is.
For Eastern Standard and the Daily Yonder, I'm Anya Slepian.
River rolls and the river winds, and it seems to do something for my peace of mind. Though I didn't know it, I came here looking to find a place to forget about my troubles for a while. Saw a mother with a little baby while I was walking here. There's something about a little baby makes me laugh. They don't seem to have a care. I wonder if I'm ever gonna feel that way again. Until then, I'll find some time to spend down by the river.
What would you find if you took a trek along the Kentucky River, top to bottom? Reggie Van Stockham has done just that, taking copious notes along the way and drawing on his observation for a book surrounding the Kentucky River from its beginning to its end. Welcome to Eastern Standard, Reggie.
Tom, what a pleasure to be back again talking to you about those things that excite me so much about our Commonwealth.
And if you would set the scene for us, where did you begin the trek? And was it by car or boat, just for clarity?
Well, let me give you an idea as to the philosophy, because I think it's something that anybody in Kentucky can embrace and do it by any means of transportation. In Kentucky, we tend to, in life, in fact, we tend to focus on the real obvious things, the real popular things, and we don't get to see all of the wonder that surrounds them. And hence my surrounding series. I have 3 books in this series, and it is my desire to go not to the things that we're drawn to initially, but to drive around, to paddle around, to hike around those areas to see what I missed. And this book took about 3 years to do, mostly by car, somewhat by canoe, and periodically hiking, in fact, even in tunnels, so railroad tunnels. It's really quite something. And I wouldn't just go to the river, because the river's pretty well known. I would go to the areas surrounding the river. Mm-hmm. And I wouldn't research them and try to go find the things that I learned about. I would simply go and try to get lost. And invariably, when I got lost, I found wonderful things, things I didn't even know existed out there, things that fired up my imagination and things that I wanted to know more about. I would come back home, I would do the research, and I would write it up as a guide for someone else who would like to be lost, like me.
So you got lost. How did you find your way back?
It's not too hard to find yourself somewhere if you just keep driving. And then when you get somewhere, you're able to figure out where that is.
All right. Well, the book is organized as 70 chapters, each about a certain point along the river. And among them all, which stands out to you as the most memorable?
A difficult question, because they are all of interest. And you can, in fact, simply open the book to any chapter and dive right in. It's a welcoming sign to places perhaps you've never been before. But there are areas that just stopped me. that I got out there and I found so much that I wanted to see and come back and see again, that I wrote more than one chapter on, several chapters. In fact, one of those areas, very early on, because I traveled from the downstream end, Carrollton, all the way up to the Three Forks, Middlesboro, Jenkins, Hyden, all the way up to Manchester, Salt Licks, in fact. But I discovered Owen County. That place is just loaded with history, loaded with interesting topography. I have a blog called The Life in Landscapes, and when I see unglaciated territory, which is what Kentucky is, I get excited at the landforms that I see, the forests that grow on them. And Owen County has just all kinds of interesting landforms, plus the lower Kentucky River going right through it. Monterey, Gratz, Lockport. Wow. The other county that just stopped me, and I have to say county, is Estill County. That's Irvin and Ravenna, just on the other side of Richmond. The Red River Gorge just sucks all of our attention because it's such a gorgeous natural resource. But it's not the only one. And one county down from it is Estill County, with many of the same features and some features that you don't find in the Red River Gorge. This is part of a geological formation called the Borden Delta. And the Borden Delta came down hundreds of millions of years ago in the Mississippian, I think, from mountain building in the northeast. And there were these subsea flooding of sediments. So there was an ocean over Kentucky. And these sediments kind of flooded in underneath. They're called the Borden Delta. And in Estill County, along Station Camp Creek, especially the middle fork of Station Camp Creek, you find geodes that are so special with microcrystalline structure that they're called Kentucky agates. And you don't find that kind of mineralization anywhere else in Kentucky.
So for the listener who's hearing this, who might decide to pick up this book and use it as a guide, what else should they take along for the trek, first of all, in addition to the book?
Well, you want to make sure you have your smartphone and that you have your two map apps. And let me say that on the Maps app, the Apple Map and the Google Maps there, the Google Map has a terrain app, a terrain view. And that's the one I use. And it shows the lovely terrain that I'm traveling through. And that's my primary. I also have a Garmin GPS, and that works off satellite. So I load that up and I figure out where I am. And then if I get out of cell service, I can still track myself with that. You want to take a field car, a car that's got some power, a car that's got as many wheel drive as you can get. I take little jacks and I take little grates to stick under my wheels if I get stuck so I can jack it up and still get myself out. You want to take food. You want to take clothing. You never know when you might get stuck and you may have to wait a little while. And of course, you want to tell your friends and your family where you're going and when you expect to be out. Other than that, you want the book, of course, will help. There are also a Delorme map of Kentucky, and there Kentucky has a good general map, too.
So where can the book be found?
Well, you can find it primarily at my blog site, www.vanstockham.blog. All of my books are there, and I'm pleased to have people come by and look.
Well, the book is Surrounding the Kentucky River from Its Beginning to Its End by Reggie Van Stockham. We thank you so much for joining us, Reggie.
Tom, I look forward to the next time that we travel the river.
Sounds good. Thanks for joining us. Eastern Standard is produced at the studios of Dynamics Productions. Mike Savage, executive producer, Neil Kesterson, sound designer and technical director, Crystal Jones, general assignment reporter, Chris Begley, special topics reporter, and Ella Fitzgeraldine, studio dog. We're online at esweku.org, where you can check out the Eastern Standard archive, our series, our partners, and more, and you can sign up for our weekly e-newsletter. You can find Eastern Standard online at weku.org, on the WEKU app, and anywhere you get podcasts, including Apple and Spotify. Would you like to call something to our attention or maybe suggest a topic? Email us at es@eku.edu. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.